Convene the meeting. Welcome to the January 25th, 2021 virtual commission meeting. I think we've got.
Hey, Will, just to let you know, I don't see Commissioner Pascal yet.
Oh, okay. All right, good.
And while we're waiting for him, I sent you, you three gentlemen, the commissioners, a letter this morning, and I will read it if it's okay, but if I could just get a response to it, that would be okay too. You know, I don't really need to read it. If I could just hear whether that you accepted it, that you received the letter.
Well, it's up to you. If you want to read it, that's fine.
Okay.
I received it, yeah.
Pardon me?
Yeah, fine with me too.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure it wouldn't take up extra time.
Okay, good. All right, we've been called to order. First item on the agenda is approval of the consent agenda for January 25th, 2021.
Will,
we're still waiting for Rick. Can we text him and see what's if he's
yeah. I'll try to give him a call and see.
Yes, I'm doing that right now.
You calling him, T?
Yes.
All right, thanks.
Can I ask a question while we're just sitting here, just for my own curiosity, from something that was brought up last week about the Audubon Society? I was under the impression that the new building that the Jamestown Tribe is building actually is going to have solar power panels. Is that not correct?
I don't know.
No? Okay. I'll check on that this week because I was just curious because we had donated back when we did the community solar, remember, down on in Squim. I had donated 10 of those units to the Audubon Society, and at that time I thought they were telling me that their new building was going to have solar. So, anyway, I'm just curious that if they're having line problems, maybe they need to hook it up to the solar that they're going to be building or something.
Are you talking about the Audubon building there at the railway bridge?
Yes, correct. That's correct.
Oh, okay. I thought you said Jamestown, but okay.
Well, it is the Jamestown Tribe is who's building that.
Oh, really?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, right. It's
good for them.
Right.
I think those are two different locations, Christine. Where building versus where the strikes are on the power line.
Oh, okay.
Doug, I did call Rick. And he did not answer. His voicemail came on. I left a message. So I don't know if you want to proceed without him or wait a few minutes.
Does Rick have an e-pad or a phone, a PUD phone?
iPad.
Why don't we get him a phone? He needs a phone because he's...
I can get him a district phone if he needs one.
Well, he does.
I just sent him an email, too. Might be having connection problems, so.
Yeah. There's a lot of that going around these days. I've had more calls fail in the last few weeks than I've had in previous years.
Well, I guess, Will, you could get started if you wanted. I do have agenda revisions, but if you want to try to do the consent first.
All right. We'll go ahead and do the consent agenda. This is items itemized on the agenda there. I won't read them all. This is for January 25th, 2021. Do we have a motion?
Will, I have some comments and questions on the minutes of the meeting.
Okay.
First, if I may, a process question here. When I was reviewing my duties as the new secretary that you guys lined me up for, I found in the Board of Governance policy that I'm responsible for reviewing the accuracy of the minutes, presumably before they go out. I don't know what Dave had been doing in the past or anything, but obviously that has to happen before the minutes are posted or sent to the other commissioners and so forth and are posted on the website. So can you enlighten me as to what's been going on in the past? And because I know what I would need to do to do this. So.
Well, go ahead, Doug.
I was just going to say, I believe in the past, Jim, what we did is when we sent it to all commissioners, that all three of them reviewed it because some of them had direct comments in there. And that, like this particular minutes, we will call back to T with a change on the Horn Rapids solar project that he talked about.
That was one of the things I saw too. Megawatts.
Right. So,
well, I guess as secretary, it would seem to me that working with T, that I should go over with her first. And then send them out to the commissioners for further, because, what you're saying is that we get them virtually the same time as the public does. That is the case. And
right.
So I would think that T and I should go over them before that happens.
Okay. Well, we can do. What we do is send it to all those that made any comments on the staff side that are on the minutes first. They look them over, but then they make any changes. And then we could send it to you, or we could send it to all three commissioners the day before the packet goes out and have you, or all three of you, because all three are making different comments, and then send them back, and then you can give a final review or something like that if you want.
Yeah, there's something to be said for sending it out to all commissioners because a lot of the times that any corrections are usually in commissioner reports. So I think that that might be a worthwhile exercise.
We'll do that. We can do that a day ahead of time to get it to you.
Wait a minute. So if it's going to all three commissioners a day ahead of time, like on Thursday, that doesn't give me as a secretary much time to, basically check for accuracy.
Yeah, we don't get them finalized till Wednesday or Thursday ourselves usually too. But
this is Tia, and I can definitely work on getting them typed up the day after the meeting or so, and then get them out to all the commissioners at the same time.
Okay,
Tia.
Yeah, I can't hear you too well, but are you saying you could have it done Tuesday? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I don't see why I couldn't have it done Tuesday. What I've been doing is I've been waiting for the recording to get posted online so that I can go over my notes and make sure I didn't miss anything, but I can do that if the posting can get
okay, would that work, Jim? We send it to all three of you on Tuesday before the following Monday.
That should be just enough time, barely, as long as we don't have a bunch of WAPUTA meetings in there or something. But yeah, let's try that. We get it on Tuesday. Give all three commissioners a day to respond, and then I will check it just for accuracy, doing my job. And,
okay.
Then it could go out.
Okay.
That's the process comment. I had two corrections. Will has already pointed out one. The other one, I thought we should have put a little bit more detail, just another sentence or two, in the discussion about the EDC and Northwest River Partners. That was an important discussion, and I think it's not that thoroughly, or I know we don't need to document everything, but I would suggest some recommend. I would like to make some add a sentence or two in there on each of those, the EDC and Northwest River Partners, to into the minutes. And I went back and listened to the recording, and you know, to kind of gather what we did, and that's what I based on. So I would like to fix it and send it back out to the commissioners. And so we need to pull the minutes out of the consent package, is what I'm saying.
Okay. Any changes, you know, needs to reflect what actually went on in the meeting.
Well, that's what I'm pointing out, is I'm reflecting back on the recording of the meeting and checking notes very carefully.
Okay, so we can pull that minutes out for this month and or this last meeting and put it on the next meeting for getting approval.
Rick, did you hear that discussion?
You're muted, Rick.
Rick, I don't think he's hearing us.
He's trying to unmute himself there.
Joe?
Oh, they're okay. He's in now.
The commissioners do know that the minutes are posted to the website, the recording of the minutes. So they can hear the actual recording of the minutes a day or two after the meeting.
Okay.
So.
So how soon afterwards are they on there, T?
Well, it's been a couple of days, but I don't see why IT can't put them up a little sooner.
Well, let's do what we said. We'll have it you'll send it to the three commissioners the Tuesday before the following meeting, and then the commissioners have a day to get back, and then Jim can give a final review and give you the okay on it.
Okay.
Hey, Rick, are you on now?
Yes, sir.
Ah, okay. Well, did you hear that discussion?
Yes, sir.
You in agreement?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. All right, do I have a motion for the consent agreement without the sans, the minutes, which we will defer to next meeting?
Hey, Will.
Yes,
I'm sorry, Jim. What I should probably read for the public, because they didn't see it, it's under agenda revisions, but Will had sent in a change on that. Well, I guess we're doing the minutes over again, so I apologize. We'll just get that comment because that'll be changed in the next minute. So go ahead, Jim. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I move that we approve the consent agenda for claim vouchers from January 11th through January 19th for a total of $4,316,328. Payroll vouchers for the period of December 16th through December 31st, 2020, and contractor pre-qualification for Northwest Utility Services for the upcoming calendar year in the amount of $1 million.
Do I have a second?
I second.
All right, it's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda as revised for January 25th, 2021. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
All right. Under agenda revisions, I have one so far. We're going to move Sean Worthington's presentation on amending the district's investment policy to up above comments from the public.
I'm sorry, Will. I'm having communication problems, I guess. What we want to move is Sean Delplaine's. Sean DelPlains.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, well.
Move it up before comments.
We've got too many Seans. We needed Sean 1, Sean 2.
Right.
Okay. All right, so we'll move right into that. Is Sean on?
Yes, sir. I am here.
Okay, well, go ahead, Sean.
Commissioners, we renegotiated a contract with NOAANet for our internet pricing, and I am passing that along in the new proposal there. We will be able to flat rate the ISPs and pretty much double their capacity with no rate change for them. And that is what the pricing changes reflect.
Well, historically, do the ISPs pass on that cost to their customers, or do they mark it up quite a bit?
It's difficult for me to say. I think each ISP is different. I do know that it makes it so they don't pass on a greater charge because we are charging them more. They will be able to double their bandwidth without incurring a greater charge from us.
Okay. All right. Do we have questions or comments at all you had, Sean?
Yes, sir.
Help me out here. In the BOC package and on the website was a list of fees and services changes. Is this the same thing you're talking about? Is this a separate issue for internet?
There's a list of different bandwidth amounts, and each of those prices changed based on what we are being billed by NOAANet. And I just simply went through the pricing structure and was able to double what each ISP has on their current pricing structure.
So if I understand what I was reading is that there's significant price reduction in the various hookup fees and monthly fees, primarily monthly fees. Am I reading that right?
I think it is a pretty good reduction, yes. We were able to drop what we were being billed in half, and I was able to pass that along to the ISPs.
But that's only a reduction for the ISPs. Their end users, it's really going to be up to them.
Correct.
Which is kind of bothers me, but that's the way it is.
Well, it's a start, at least. You know, if we can reduce our costs, let's, you know, if the customers know this, then maybe they can pressure the ISPs. Last year when we talked about this, I believe I made the point that, or I asked if this had been out for public review more than just the period of, you know, like this one came out Friday. Has this thing been open for public comment for more than just the last 3 days?
No, sir.
I guess for propriety's sake, it probably should, even though we're reducing the cost. But I think of something like this where we're presenting these kind of fees to the public, they ought to at least see them for 2 weeks.
Well, I doubt you're going to have an objection to more capacity at a lower cost, but
I know that, but I'm just saying we should establish a sort of a procedure, but because we were going to do that last time.
Well, we can't wait for 2 weeks. This is Steve. We could wait for 2 weeks. It's not an imperative that we do it right this second. So
then I would ask that we defer passing the voting on this resolution, give the public 2 weeks to respond, and we'll go from there.
Okay. Sean, do you have any comment on that?
I do not.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I mean, our position all along, I hear what Jim's saying, is supporting the ISPs, so and helping them to do a good job for all our customers, and that's what Sean and the IT group has been doing all along, and that's where we've been concentrating. But understand what you're saying. I guess I didn't know that the broadband actually filled into that category. Usually the first of the year when we give you the rates on all the other electrical and water, it's separate from this. So I apologize for not realizing that you wanted it for something like this too.
And there may be a benefit that the ISP, the public, the customers of ISPs learn that their cost has gone down and so on. So,
right. I mean, it's a good news story.
It's good news. Exactly. That's right. Okay. Well, Rick, do you agree to table this to next for 2 weeks?
I think that's a good idea.
Okay, great. All right. We'll move back and get comments from the public. Sean, do we have anybody?
Yeah. I know for a fact, Christine Reed wants to read a letter that she submitted to everybody this morning. But if anybody else wants to make a comment after Christine, please give me your first name now, and I will call on you afterwards.
Okay, Christine, go ahead.
Okay. The following letter I sent is a follow-up to January 13th letter in which I expressed concern for lack of documentation supporting the association dues agenda item. After that meeting, I submitted a public records request, which was quickly fulfilled. After reviewing the May and December 2020 Northwest River Partners correspondence, I'm of the opinion that Klon PUD should reconsider general membership in that nonprofit organization and should not donate ratepayer funds into its pro-hydro campaign. A donation of over $12,000 for a pro-hydro digital media campaign specifically geared to influence a targeted segment of the population, which was identified as Gen Z and millennials, is not good use of ratepayer funds. Although a masterful red herring marketing strategy, the premise that hydropower is an all-or-nothing proposition is just a straw man fallacy. I know of no advocacy group or environmental activism promoting removal of every hydropower-producing installation in the Columbia River System's operations. In my opinion, Northwest River Partners' campaign can be more accurately categorized as a media blitz narrowly focused on preserving the status quo of the four lower Snake River dams at the continued detriment of the entire Pacific Northwest ecosystem and its indigenous communities' treaty rights. As a ratepayer, I already contribute to Bonneval Power Administration's marketing of power produced throughout the Pacific Northwest. That enormous infrastructure was mostly built by the Corps of Engineers and maintained by the Bureau of Reclamation using taxpayer dollars. I have and continue to appreciate all the benefits of this decades-old system. However, after considering all three avenues for funding, I don't believe my ratepayer dollar should be donated to a nonprofit for its narrowly focused media campaign. Commissioners, I sincerely request you reconsider the decision to donate ratepayer revenue in support of Northwest River Partners nonprofit organization, and especially please reconsider funding its media campaign. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Okay, thank you, Christine.
You're welcome, thank you.
Sean, do we have others?
I didn't hear any others, but we can open it back up if you want, Will.
Okay, yeah, sure.
If anybody wants to make a comment, go ahead and give me your first name now.
It sounds like we don't have anyone.
Yeah, hearing none.
Okay, moving back to business items, we have a resolution 2190-21 amending the district's investment policy. Sean, I think I've got you as the presenter for that.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. So back in 1996, the district adopted an investment policy through resolution 1520-96. And in that policy, there's a section 10F that stipulates that no more than $1 million can be invested in any single financial institution. There are a few exclusions, U.S. government obligations, the Washington State LDIP, and then also the district's money market account are excluded from that cap. So from 1996 to 2008, we had an amendment to the policy with resolution 1885 that raised that $1 million limit to $3 million. And the resolution before you is amending that $3 million and raising it to $6 million. Basically, through the years, the district has more investable funds, and we currently have an opportunity to move some of the monies that we currently have invested with the LGIP to a credit union in Washington State that's at five times the rate of return as the LGIP through a CD. And so, therefore, we would recommend that you adopt Resolution 2190-21 as presented, amending the district's investment policy and rescinding the prior resolution 1885-08. And so, if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Yeah, I have a question. Your statement kind of implied we've got stacks of money sitting around to invest. Most of this is bond proceeds. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. We have most of our investments in the Washington State LGIP, and as you know, last year all interest rates for the most part just absolutely tanked to almost nothing.
Yeah.
I think the LGIP is currently at maybe 0.1%. And then this CD that we have the opportunity to move some of the money into is at 0.6%. So still low, but, you know, again, it's five times what we're getting with the LGIP. And it's also through a Washington State certified public financial institution.
Sean, a follow-on question to Will. So, for instance, is our reserve, 20-whatever million it is that the kind of money you're talking about that would be in these investment accounts?
Right. Yeah, they are reserves.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay. Other questions, discussion? Okay. Well, do I have a motion?
Yeah, I'll move that we adopt Resolution 2190-21, amending the district's investment policy.
I second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded for approval of Resolution 2190-21, amending the district's investment policy established in Resolution 1885-08, which will be amended. All those in favor? Aye.
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 Thank you, Commissioners.
Okay, thank you. All right, I think that's all the business items. We'll move on to correspondence and communication. Doug, I think you've got the first one, DOE letter to governors, prioritization of vaccines for energy employees.
Yeah, I've got about six of them here, Will.
Okay.
correspondence things I'll go over. First one is what you had just mentioned. On January 14th, the Energy Secretary, Dan Brulette, I think that's how you pronounce it, urged the governors of 55 states and territories to prioritize critical infrastructure mission essential workers during the response to COVID-19 pandemic. He quote there from it says, the energy sector provides around-the-clock electricity and ensures the free flow of energy products necessary for the health and safety of all Americans. These critical energy workers support and preserve the infrastructure and operation centers critical to maintaining the backbone of the energy system. By prioritizing their health and safety for vaccine distribution alongside other frontline workers, we assure continuous distribution of energy to the nation's rural and urban communities. So that was from the Secretary of Energy. So they're basically supporting us as some of the other organizations such as WAPUTA has done. The second item I have here was a letter that I received, an email I received from John Harlow. He's the general manager of Snowpug PUD. Those you probably don't know, but in the last outage, we were done in a day or so. But Snowpug continued for a number of days, and they called upon utilities to come and help. And that's part of our mutual aid that we have with them, and they have with us. We could call them and all the other utilities pretty much in Washington, too. And actually, we have one with APPA, so throughout the country. But anyway, John sent me an email back, and he said, "Hi, Doug. I hope you and your family are doing well and staying safe and healthy. I apologize for the delay on my thank you, but on behalf of all Snohomish County PUD and our customers, I want to say thank you for your response in our time of need to restore power to our customers. We were blindsided by a severe winter storm with a magnitude of severity we have not seen in many years. At the height of the storm, we had over 93,000 customers out of power and ended up restoring power to over 200,000 outages, which included over 300 line crew jobs in 4 days. Collin County crews represented themselves very well, and the commitment that Collin County has shown as a public power partner is amazing. Your crew was professional while keeping safety the number one for the crew and our citizens, which is our highest value. We appreciate all your efforts, and if and when Collin County is in a time of need, please don't hesitate to reach out to us at Snohomish for help. We look forward to the continued partnership. Sincerely, John. So that was a nice response there. And for commissioners and the public, you should know that when we do get calls for mutual aid, it's something that we look at very closely, because if it looks like we're going to be having any storms coming up, you know, that's something we won't allow our crews to disappear for a length of time. So we take that into consideration. In this particular storm, it was over for us, and the weather looked good for the next number of days. So we were happy to go help them out. And as you can see, they were happy to get our help. So I just want to thank our crews for the great job in representing us in a professional manner. All right. The third thing I had was at the last meeting, the questions of EDC and Northwest River Partners came up, and we were to look in to see what validity they had for us participating. Excuse me. So EDC first. We went out to the other PUDs, and in a very quick response, we got 16 of them responded to us. And 11 of the 16 PUDs responded that they do support their EDCs in their counties. And the dollar ranged from $500 to $25,000. So it's quite a wide range of support. Six of the 11 was less than the $10,000 that we had offered and are working with EDC and getting a contract together. So we're somewhat in the middle, and it seems like it's something that we feel that is justified at this time. We did look at the scope of work that EDC provided us, and I'll mention a few of the things that they have on there that we feel could provide the PUD a benefit. One of the things is recruitment and marketing activity. EDC has hosted and facilitated or coordinated several meetings with potential large load customers that included significant information transfer between the PD and the prospective customers. So when they do have a large customer that's looking like it's coming into the county, or potentially looking at us, comparing us to other counties, other locations, EDC does work with bringing us on board to make sure that we can answer their questions and they can answer any of our questions. Also, they market the PUD as an excellent location to expand or relocate a business, and positioning Clallam as a competitive place to grow a business, which may include developing and executing regional plans to attract companies from out of the area. Another item that they do that we feel like we could get some benefit out is business retention and expansion activities of our businesses that we have in the county already. This last year, they had 18 outreach interactions initiated with existing businesses, such as phone calls and site visits or surveys in the PUD jurisdiction. And there was 48 follow-up interactions initiated with existing businesses in the PUD jurisdiction. So we feel that we can justify our participation to some degree. It doesn't say the dollar amount, but it does say that I believe the commissioners were in the right, were right in supporting EDC to some extent. The next one I had is
quick question, Doug.
Yeah.
That $25,000, those were the larger utilities like Chelan?
No, actually it was.
Well, I think Chelan was one of them.
They might be. That was, let me check here. Well, just a second. I'm sorry. Benton, I think, was the $25,000 one. No, I'm sorry. Grays Harbor was the $25,000 one. Benton was $20,000, Cowlitz was $16,000, and then there's a whole bunch of, Franklin was $10,000, similar to what we did. Mason, one was $1,500, Okanagan was $6,000, Pacific was $7,500, Stevens was $1,525, Wakayakan was 500. Jefferson was interesting. Jefferson doesn't support, or I shouldn't say doesn't support, but doesn't provide any funding, or I don't believe they're a member of their EDC in Jefferson County. So that was an interesting fact.
All right. One other question, going back to mutual aid, what is Bonneville's role in that, if any? Or do they, I'm sure it's limited to their system. Did Snohomish experience any Bonneville outages?
You know, I don't know, Will. I don't know.
All right.
My guess is they've got a large enough territory with enough customers that a lot of the outages, I mean, what our guys went over there is work on distribution mostly. So
yeah.
I think their distribution was hit severely too. Okay.
Doug, Will,
yeah.
I'm back on the EDC thing. Yeah, I agree with your analysis, Doug, and the findings. And I also, you know, based on the EDC's work during COVID, which they kept a lot of businesses from going out of business, which is our rate money, they've also done a lot of work restoring a previous customer out at Forks, the the lumber mill out there, and hopefully that's going to come through. So I think these are significant actions on their part to preserve and, as you mentioned, to maintain our customer base. I would recommend that we at least restore their funding, that request of $15,000 that we initially talked about 2 weeks ago, and which I think is more fitting for the level of work and the size that we are.
Okay, did you have anything else, Doug?
Yes, I did. Okay. Northwest River Partners is another one that you had asked us to look into. And we went out to our electric PUDs there, and 17 of the 24 members of Northwest River Partners, so extreme majority of other PUDs are members of Northwest River Partners. They, you know, River Partners does support the hydropower along with the wildlife and environmental protection support, as I think they understand the role of the hydropower system holds, especially nowadays with CETA too, that makes a big difference. They help the utilities get messages out to the customers about how hydro is clean, renewable, and helps keep our rates among the lowest in the nation. They do look from the wildlife, as Fish and Wildlife standpoint, too. During the time that we haven't been members, we weren't able to join the other PUDs and be able to share some of the good social media about hydro that River Partners does put out. There has been surveys in the past from River Partners and from others that had shown that the public is not real well aware of what hydro does and what benefits the hydro does have, and they've done some surveys to show that the public needs to be informed more, and that's kind of where the media part of their request that came to us is valid, in that the public is not that knowledgeable on how clean and renewable a hydro system is. So I believe from what we looked at, we felt that the investment in River Partners was justified, or can be justified. And so it's another one that I believe we should support too.
Yeah, I get some of the history behind that is that some years ago, the city council in Seattle passed a resolution that was anti-hydro and so on. So they, and what was driving that was younger people that didn't even realize where their power came from. They thought it came from the receptacle. And so the group of the council members were treated to a tour of the hydro system and given data on importance to the region and so on, and they did somewhat rescind that. And as far as going for the Generation Z and the millennials, in the past, there have been surveys that indicated that that group especially did not understand the power industry, the benefits of the hydro system. So that's maybe the reason they're targeting that group. So anyway.
I don't know of any utility, not in the Northwest not in the Northwest, that wouldn't give up their right arm for the hydro system that we have up here. And we need to let our, like you're saying, let our public know how valuable it is to us.
I'd like to comment on that, though. That's all fine, what you're saying. I don't disagree with, educating the public, especially our ratepayers, what's important for our ratepayers here in Clallam County. But I have to say that many of the documents that or parts of documents that Northwest River Partners puts out have misleading information in them. I have mentioned this before. I've gone through one of them here recently and would like to point out, if Sean, am I able to do screen sharing? I'd like to put up a document with notes on it.
Yeah, you go ahead. Yep.
Okay, thank you. Which one is it? There it is. Okay. So can you see this Northwest River Partners document on your screen?
Yes, we can see it, Jim.
Okay. So what I want to point out here, these are statements that were made by Northwest River Partners in this recent analysis done by Dr. Welch on the ocean conditions and their effect on the ecosystem and the hydrosystem and salmon and all this kind of stuff and orca. And I've noted some of the claims that were made in this paper, like the real issues leading to lower salmon survival, climate change and warming ocean, that newly established or published research has unveiled remarkable insight into the survival rates of Chinook salmon populations. This study that Welch did meets a level of scientific rigor that other studies are not required to meet. Dams do not appear to be a key limiting factor for recovery. This is pivotal research. This study is supported by deep technical scientific analysis. Dr. Welch makes a convincing case. He provides solid reasoning that greater dam passage does not usually cause lower survival rates. Now, here's what the Fish Passage Center has said about that same report. And you have to keep in mind, the Fish Passage Center is where ratepayers fund the Fish Passage Center from Bonneville Power Administration to do this kind of research. They've been around since the Power Planning Act in 1980. They're very respected. And so here's how, just a summary of some of the things on this same report. They, in terms of the mentions in the report, they found the Center for Fish Passage found 9 fails in terms of their mentions, 6 representations, 6 ignoring the facts, 9 attempts of nine times lacking any attempt to research further. Here's some excerpts from the Fish Passage Center. Again, this is our rate money here by the agency that's supposed to be telling us about fish passage and salmon and so forth. The report is highly flawed, has major errors and omissions, demonstrably false, broad novel conclusions that contradict the large body of evidence, erroneous conclusions, technically flawed, inappropriate. And I'll just, I'm not going to read every one of these, but, they act up, they end up with Welch 2020 clearly do not provide such evidence as claimed by Northwest River Partners. Acting against this requirement, the lacks thereof should inform how credible we consider resulting conclusions. A whole litany of examples. Now, I could give you more. I told you last time about their attempt to cherry-pick data from Environmental Protection Agency's temperature TMDL study on the snake. They misrepresented that to WAPUTA. I commented on that. I think you guys, if you haven't seen those comments, I'll provide them to you. And I can provide this document too, because I go in and basically pull out the very the quotes from the paragraphs in the Fish Passage Center and can provide that. But this is just one example of why, in spite of the philosophy behind what you said about Northwest River Partners or anybody like them, this is not what they're doing. They're producing information that is simply invaluable. I mean, not valuable at all. It's fraught with errors. And if we're going to fund them, then I don't want to fund them. I think they're a waste of money, like I said last time. But if we get stuck with them, then I'm going to have to retort, and take the time to peel these things apart, just like I did here.
Let me just make one comment. River Partners, Public Power Council, these other organizations, and I think you just kind of cherry-picked one item here, but they don't produce data. They rely on NOAA, Corps of Engineers, the Bonneville, and any other weather service, and on it goes, for their data, and it's kind of a pass-through. So I think that what you're pointing out there is kind of an anomaly. There's comments on, and in fact, Bonneville has funded in the past as part of their mitigation of the impact of salmon, organizations which are produce data which is not consistent with other organizations. So anyway, I'm not too sure that this is that damning.
Well, here's another one, and I'm telling you, there's a long list of misleads on their part. This one was one they talked about southern resident killer whales being primarily preying on primarily or saying that the Columbian Snake Rivers do not represent a significant source of prey for the southern residents, when in fact NOAA has said that the Columbian snake are two of the four top priority Chinook populations for southern residents. In fact, NOAA says that 50% of the Chinook that the southern resident eats comes from the Columbia snake system. So, we're not cherry picking here. I'm not cherry picking things here. What I'm pointing out, it's a continuous kind of philosophy of theirs to cherry pick. They're the ones that are cherry picking certain studies, certain parts of studies like the TMDL report, and pulling stuff out that is out of context. And so I stand on what I'm saying, because it's not just me. This is these are government sources, like you mentioned, the Corps of Engineers, BPA. This is their stuff, and it's just being twisted around by Northwest River Partners.
Okay. All right, thank you. Other comments, questions?
I've got a couple more here, Will, to share with you.
I don't know, Doug. You're go ahead. That's fine.
Well, actually, I was looking for a NOAA report where it kind of said that everything was okay, but I can't find it, so I won't put it up. If we can get that off the screen, I'll go ahead. Well, I don't have anything to put on the screen.
And I am okay. Wait a minute. I see. Stop here. I got it. Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. Then I've got one that just came in this last week from Waputa to support House Bill 1336. And just wanting the public to know that WAPUTA has put this out. It's creating and expanding unrestricted authority for public entities to provide telecommunication services to end users. So the public utility districts currently have the authority to provide wholesale service, and in very specific instances, limited retail service. House Bill 1336 would provide authority for public entities to include public utility districts to provide broadband services to end users. So just letting you know, a bill was dropped that is looking at allowing PUDs to have retail services. Whether it gets passed or not, that's happened a few years. It still hasn't passed, but there's more talk about it. And especially with COVID, it's become more of an issue, a higher priority. So yeah, that's that.
I was in the legislative update last week, and this bill has a lot of support from all sectors. So they seem to think it's gonna pass. So.
Right. Okay. The last thing I've got is we had told you last week that we're getting together with having a meeting with BPA. So the staff has set up a meeting this week on Wednesday. with BPA regarding the continuing outages and, you know, the questions that we'll be asking them, and the staff and BPA will be working on that. If the commissioners have any questions that you would like asked by the staff, I'd request that by Tuesday, by the end of the day, if you can get T and myself, maybe a list of any questions that you might have, we're happy to add them to the conversations we have with BPA on Wednesday.
Doug, I'd like to be on the call since I've the one been asking about it for a couple of years here.
Yeah, I'd like to be on there too, because I've got the, unfortunately, I've been around for a long time, so we've got some of the history and some of the questions as well. I guess the only problem with that is we would have to, well, go ahead, Doug.
I was just going to say the problem with that is it has to become a public meeting then, and public would be involved in it, and between the staff working, which they've done on a continuous basis for the last number of months, to have an open public meeting with commissioners and everything, you know, might not have the most frank discussions with BPA and our staff between us and them. So, I would prefer is for commissioners, instead of attending the meeting, we have staff has meetings with organizations, you know, every day, all the time, and they're not large public events, and we're trying to get the job done. So I guess for us it would be best if we could get questions that any of the commissioners might be interested in, you know, by the end of business Tuesday.
Yeah, and this is probably going to be worker bees and their supervision, so it's not a policy type thing. And I think a public meeting would certainly inhibit that discussion.
I mean, any high level meeting that you might want to set up, we can do that in a separate meeting with higher level people and the commissioners and the public. But I'll leave that decision up to you, commissioners.
Why don't we see how this discussion goes, and then if we think we need a higher level meeting, then we can do that. That would be
who are we meeting with?
The transmission executive for BPA for us.
Transmission executive.
Yeah, I don't have a title.
That's an account executive, is that right?
Yeah,
hey,
account
Doug,
executive, yeah.
Doug, let me, I can give a brief overview of who we're meeting with and the proposed agenda. It won't take but a few minutes.
Yeah, why don't you do that, Jim?
Okay,
John?
For BPA, we're going to be meeting with Kevin Yao, the District Operations Maintenance Manager of Olympia, Melanie Jackson, Transmission Account Executive, Chad Cloudwell, customer service engineer. Melanie and Chad are the ones we typically meet with on day-to-day business matters. Kevin, we meet with periodically on things like outages and system operations. For PD, it'll be Doug, myself, Mike Hill, the engineering manager, and Nicole Hartman. We've, as I went over last time in our presentation on outages, I believe we talked about the agenda items there, but I'll go over them again. The proposed agenda includes a review of BPA outages since the last major meeting we had with BPA back in February of 2018. We're going to talk about how we can improve how PUD assists BPA in public messaging and effectively conveying outage information to our customers in a meaningful way. We're going to talk about BPA assistance to PUD assistance to BPA of patrolling lines, and to reiterate our new policy that we implement patrols immediately upon an outage, as opposed to waiting around for any reason, treating it at the highest priority. We also want BPA to convey general BPA right-of-way maintenance practices to PUD staff, so we can make an assessment to make sure that, you know, everything is consistent with NERC standards and such. I'm sure it is, but we want to make double sure. Another topic is danger trees. Work towards identifying and removing danger trees located outside the BPA right-of-way that propose a risk of falling into the BPA lines. We believe, based on the information provided so far, that the majority of outages originate from trees outside the 100-foot right-of-way contacting the lines. Maybe we can do something about it. We know with the U.S. Forest Service and the wildfire concerns, we might be able to leverage that to get some of these trees. We also want to check in. We know that the Forest Service has been conducting thinning activities, and we want to see if we can draw a causal tie to that or not. I'm going to discuss fire mitigation. If you have tree line contacts, there's always a risk of fire. Forest fires and wildfires are a major concern now. We might leverage that. We also want to get a little bit more of a knowledge on operational limits of Port Angeles in abnormal condition under a double loss of contingency of respective transmission systems. A while back, we experienced significant delays in the SWIM area restoring power due to code load issues associated with BPA Port Angeles substation. And then we want to get a current functional one-line update of the BPA substations. So that is what we're going to be looking at, and those are the people assembled by BPA who would be best positioned to discuss those issues.
Are you going to ask the question that can the PUD help then with vegetation control, perhaps on a reimbursable basis, or is that part of the discussion?
Well, actually, we'll maybe the best thing, Doug, is for us to send the board the summary of the last meeting. A lot of the issues raised this time by the public, we talked in detail last time with BPA about actually working on or in concert with BPA, and there's some high hurdles, legal high hurdles, yeah, that would limit our rapid response to any BPA problems. So, Doug, I'd recommend that you send the for the commissioners, for them to formulate the best questions or comments to BPA. Just forward them the updated agenda as well as what we talked about last time to give them a good basis to give input into this meeting.
I think that would be good, John.
When was the last meeting you're referring to?
February 21st, 2018. It was after. Yes, it's coming up on 3 years, and that was related to outages. And it has not gotten better since that time.
Well, I guess that's my point. And I think they need to understand that at least this commissioner is very concerned about these outages out on the West End, especially because they're just reoccurring. It's a transmission problem with their line, their right-of-ways. And we needed to see a definitive plan from them about what their plan is for increasing the easement widths or whatever it takes to protect that line. And and talking about if their plan is to simply say, well, we're going to try to improve communication so we can get crews out there quicker, or we maybe try to talk to some, this has to be a comprehensive improvement to our grid. And that's what we pay money for. There's a 14% transmission increase in their tariff agreements or proposed tariffs. Let's see some of it.
Jim, we totally agree with that, and several of these agenda items are going to try to get to that kernel, so to speak. Now, what I would recommend is we're going to have the meeting. We're going to discuss these issues. We're going to bring the responses back to the commission. We also, BPA put out a customer of choice correspondence in the latter part of last year talking about specific issues. One of the things that we want to work with through the agencies such as WAPAG, and as far as costing, is basically get at transmission reliability. We want BPA to make it very public what their reliability is for the transmission out of this area. So we're totally total agreement with that. That, from a policy standpoint, and the individuals we're going to be talking about in this meeting, is more of an information collection. It may lead to a higher policy level discussion later, but we recommend going through this process first before we start talking about the really higher ups at BPA and take an issue about rates and where they put their monies. This is, a foot in the door, so to speak.
Yeah, Jim, that what you just said sounds like a script from 10 or 15 years ago. And we always run into legal constraints. We run into policy constraints. And safety is always an issue with that comes up. We can just keep pushing the rope and see what happens. But,
well, I will tell you one thing we do know now, that North Olympic Peninsula has had very negative or bad reliability for the last 4.5 years. Something has changed. We know that. And we're not the only ones talking. You also have Jefferson, Mason One, and City of Port Angeles have a dog in this hunt, so to speak.
Well, John,
I think at some point, yes, we can work through WAPAG and anybody else, but at some point we need to get with the city or whoever else, Mason, Jefferson, and saddle up and, these days have a Zoom call with Hairston or something, the administrator, or somebody at a higher level, because whatever you did 3 years ago is not having any effect. And I granted, well, I understand that there's some pretty tough high bars to when you're talking about expanding an easement or something. But let's also face it, a lot of this land, I don't know the percentage, but it's in state or federal land hands. And so we ought to be pressing BPA hard to work with those government partners at least, and then some of the private landowners as well.
Well, and one of the things we did talk about 3 years ago was a discussion of procuring the BPA transmission, assuming ownership of the line. Our hope was that they would give us a fully depreciated cost. Of course, we'd assume a lot of costs maintaining that line, but the price tag exceeded eight digits, which means it would be untenable as far as a rate increase for us to buy the line and operate it as our own. And that's largely because of capital infrastructure improvements they made in SAFO 4 years ago.
In addition to any, if we were to be able to buy their lines, I mean, it would add another crew, add more trucks, more manpower. The cost we've looked at over the years has been extreme versus having one or two outages, which are terrible during the winter season. But we have looked at different things with them. One of the things that we had done 10 plus years ago was they had gone out and scouted their lines. And they came up with, John, I think this is right, about 5,000 danger trees that were not necessarily in their easement, but they removed those danger trees. And we had probably another 5 or more years of pretty good results because of that. And with the growth of the trees along their lines, that's something else we're going to be talking to them about, is being able to do that again and take out some more of their danger trees.
Yeah, and we're going to make an attempt to do that. Of course, they're going to put a price tag on it in all likelihood, but does that get included in the 14% increase in our transmission rate? It's a good argument that it should. So we're going to touch on those issues, and once we have their responses, we'll come back and brief the board on what happened this latest time what they said they're going to do, and if it warrants a higher level discussion with BPA, perhaps that can be arranged. But this is being done primarily with the E&O group. It would have to be the higher level BPA management to cover the topics that I think the board would be interested in covering.
You know, some years ago, Mason One went round and round with Bonneville. They had a substation there that was not well maintained and caused a lot of outages. And you might want to talk to them and see if they had any success and what levers they used with Bonneville to get that corrected, if they got it corrected.
Okay, Will, so that's the last thing I had. I did have a question here about HB 1336, which I reported on, whether it would require PUDs to provide retail broadband or just allow them the opportunity if it makes sense for them, and it is the last, the latter. It wouldn't require PUDs to provide the broadband, but it would open up the door that if it would work out that we could do that.
Yeah, that would be problematic if they required PUDs. I think the price tag would be tremendous, but
the terrain we have, it would be very expensive.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, moving on. Commissioner reports. Rick, did you have anything?
I met with some folks from the EDC yesterday and had a good meeting with them. That's all I've got.
Okay, good. Jim?
Okay. Last week was pretty intense, or was it week before last, with Waputa, 3 days of meeting, and a WAPAG meeting on top of that on one day. So I'll try to summarize all this stuff, but there's a lot of territory covered. Let me find my notes here. Okay, so let me start off with Waputa. They started off with an education meeting on Wednesday morning. We had a good legal review on issues affecting commissioners, things like Public Meetings Act, Records Act, retention, liabilities, communications, and so forth. That was really good. Also had we reviewed with the education committee the new, in other words, the training program agenda, whatever you want to call it, for new commissioners. Went over that, had some ideas. I suggested in the Energy 101 presentation that we add someone that could talk about the shifting market conditions in the region as they relate to California. They were like that idea, so they're just looking for somebody, and I recommended somebody from WAPAG do that. Telecom, I'm not going through everything they talked about, but one of the highlights, they did mention 1336 that Doug just talked about, the broadband initiative. On the legislative front, they talked about B&O tax revisions for COVID relief. Waputa pointed out that the arrearages for PUDs in the state are about $21 million as of a few months ago. So it's starting to be a significant amount of money. Another legislative initiative is removing the 1 megawatt cap on community solar projects. And they also pointed out that they're trying to work with the state and so forth, the inconsistencies between the cap and trade and CETA legislations. The energy I was in on, but, I guess, Will, you're going to talk about that. You or Rick, you guys are the energy guys now. I can fill in, although one thing that I looked into a little bit more is the they gave a little bit of a presentation on the California heat storm that occurred last August in Southern California and what the effects were on the region. I'm not sure why they felt it necessary, because there was really no impacts to this region. But they pointed out that dispatchable resources couldn't handle the issue. But looking at the FERC report, it's interesting to see that part of the problem was is they it seems silly, but they were not projecting solar power to ramp down at the end of the day. They were using an average, which left their prediction, their plan, short of about 1,200 megawatts of solar power. There also were two, and while this was going on, since they had overestimated solar at 7 o'clock at night, they were still exporting power out of Southern California in the face of a shortage because of the ramp down in solar, which is entirely predictable, and they got a chart in a FERC report that shows that. The other couple things is that there was on the 2 days, the 14th and 15th of August, there was two different natural gas plants shut down. It's hard to tell, but one of them may have been an unplanned outage, but the other one was a planned outage. And so a planned outage and a predicted heat wave is kind of what's going on here. Demand response fell short. In other words, people said they could, as they were heading into the heat wave, could lower their loads by X percent. That didn't happen, and so they ended up short there too. So the other thing that's not in the FERC report, though, is the pricing that was going on. And I think that's to really get a picture of what's going on here. What were prices doing for power there and here? Because that's where it begins to affect it, is the price of power, whether it's our secondary power, which Bonneville made a lot of money off during those few days selling the secondary power. But the question really becomes, okay, so this was not a resource adequacy issue as much as it was a dispatching issue and planning issue and a marketing issue. In other words, what the markets were doing. And so I think you got to keep that in mind as you look at this. That's all I'll have on energy. Now for the board meeting on Friday, it kind of summarized a lot of the things in the previous day's meeting. And I won't repeat those, of course, but I'm trying to think is look at something that wasn't covered. I thought it was interesting. Oh, yeah, Scott Wilson from BPA came in, and he does this at pretty much every board meeting. It kind of went down a couple things. I thought it was interesting. He said that John Harrison, who was acting administrator and who was officially promoted or given that senior executive position, that civil service position to be the administrator. He's reported to have said he's not a cheerleader for EIM, and he's going to give it a fresh look. And I'm glad because, and I think some other commissioners are around the area too, that needs to be looked at a little bit closer before we jump in. Scott pointed out that flex spill was slightly positive. They lost money in the spring, but made it up in August when prices were high. And I'm trying to think here. We also went over the talking points for what will be a virtual visit to Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. Doug, you pointed out that, you know, for the talking, there was a talking point around the Snake River, and you pointed out that we should abstain. Because we have a neutral position on that. And I guess that's pretty kind of true, but we never really, had a resolution or voted on anything. We just had some kind of discussions based on issues coming in, whether it was Public Power Council or whatever else. So I think you were mostly accurate. Will, I didn't understand why you said that there's two commissioners that have a different opinion since we haven't talked about it with the new commissioner. The let me think. I think those are some of the highlights of the board meeting that, but like I said, they covered a lot of the same thing that were in the subcommittees. Okay, so the WAPAG meeting that was taking place, so that cut me to go to the WAPAG meeting. I skipped the water and a couple other meetings of the WAPUTA. I don't know if maybe Will or Rick were in on those. But the let me find my WAPAG notes. Okay, so the WAPAG meeting continued with their presentations by PUDs and utilities of different types and so forth. And so they've gone through about 10 or about 12 or 16 of them. I know the four that talked, Lakeview, Cowlitz, who else was there, Pacific, and one other, who was the other one? I can't think of who that was. But to summarize some of the things they're saying, number one, most of these, as was in the previous meeting, are showing no, they're basically saying they're predicting flat load growth over the foreseeable future. They have poverty rates kind of similar to Clallam. They're quite different. Some of them have, like Calix has, three wind farms, roughly 100 megawatts of wind, and so forth. And they're, you know, but one, I guess, to sort of, like I said, they all were predicting flat load growth. They also, in talking about, WAPAG was asking, what are your concerns about the future with the BPA contracts and all that kind of stuff? And basically, they're looking for flexibility in these contracts. They're looking for affordable rates. In other words, how do we keep the rates low in terms of the outlook in the future? And also shorter term, contracts. Does it have to be a 20-year contract? So those are some of the summations in that front. The other thing that WAPAG did, and I am going to, if I can, Sean, I would like to share two WAPAG slides, if I may, and just to, because it's easier to see these. Now,
you should be able to share, Jim.
You guys have my, I'm sorry, what did you say?
You should be able to share now.
Okay. Some of you, I guess, Will, you've seen these, and some people that get the WAPAG slides, but just to make sure we're communicating across the board here, these are two slides that talk about the rate increases. And as we mentioned last time, BPA in the next rate case, which is the 22, starting in 2022, they're predicting flat increases on the power side. But what WAPAG is pointing out is that this zero rate increase is because they're forecasting approximately $170 million more in secondary revenue per year. And like I mentioned last time, these are based on models that have a lot of assumptions in them. And I think we should watch this very closely, particularly over the next 12 months, to see if these forecasts are holding true, because this is what their savings is. Or, you know, their flat rate increases based on the money BPA made or they're going to put into the rate case. They're proposing $95 million a year go to revenue financing. This is basically paying down the Treasury debt in order to make keep the borrowing limit at 1.5. Had they not done that and given that back to the PUDs, we would have seen an average of 4.5% rate decrease compared to where we are today, which there's, you know, a lot of opinion that maybe that's what they should have done. And another point that WAPAG made that is very critical is that all through the discussions of the EIM and other issues relating to the rate case and so forth, the main issue is that the biggest monetary impact was dropped on them, all of us, at the last minute. WAPAG did a great job of trying to respond, but it was basically a last-minute kind of thing. So, whoops, I didn't mean to do that. Go back to slide five. But anyway, there's a couple more notes about what it's doing to their borrowing authority. That you note there that they're trying to always aim to preserve at least $1.5 billion borrowing authority for liquidity and emergency purposes, and also to keep their bond ratings up. That's sort of the threshold where the Fitches and so forth start lowering their rating if it gets below $1.5 billion. But anyway, these are a couple of the key things that came out of the WAPAG meeting that I think our PUD needs to pay particular attention to. And I thought this slide was interesting. No, not this one. That's not it. All right. Well, anyway, they've showed what CLOWM's increase is over since the WP10, which was one of the earliest rate cases, or not the earliest, but from 10 years ago. And our rates have increased 36%, and we're the third highest of the PUDs. Port Angeles is the highest at 38% rate increase over this period. So I think we need to pay particular attention to what BPA is doing here, and through WAPAG and directly to BPA with the QBRs. And the next QBR is on the 9th of February. So I believe that's all I had. Will, thank you. And I guess you turned it off.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Kind of interesting on the EIM. I think John Hairston is going to take a fresh look at that. You know, the commitment that's made by Bonneville to do an analysis of any impact to preference customers in the Northwest. And to my knowledge, that hasn't happened. I know Elliot Mainzer was a big advocate of EIM, kind of ironic that he went down to California to take over as director of CalISO. Think there might be some connection there. But anyway.
Yeah, it's worth looking into, actually.
Conspiracy theory.
There's a rule about federal employees leaving a federal job and going to a private job to do the same thing.
Yeah, well, he must have dodged that one. But in any case, I think Hairston will take a fresh look at that and live up to those commitments. Let's hope so. All right, a lot of things going on here last week. A lot of it Energy Northwest related. We had I'm on a CEO selection committee, and we had two or three phone conferences about that. We're kind of getting our toes in the water on that, so it's not a lot to report. I'm also on a committee for resource adequacy, and we talked about that. Mainly those conversations center around the small modular, the new nuclear, emphasis on the TerraPower and X Energy and NuScale. There seems to be a lot of interest there. I think I've reported before that Grant is very serious about taking a position on in a small modular reactor at Site 1 next to Columbia Generating Station. And their model would be that they would actually own the project and then sign power sales agreements with other utilities that are of interest. So that's out into the future, but that's ongoing. I got in late to the Energy Committee at Waputo because I had a conflict with another meeting, but Jim, I think you did a good job of summarizing that. I also got into the Government Affairs Committee at Waputo. A lot of talk about CETA, and then and there's kind of an overlap with the legislative update, which I attended on, I think it was Thursday of last week. The main issue there is, of course, the Telecom Authority for PUDs, which is supported by WAPUTA. And we've already kind of covered that. The big issue that was talked about was the Washington Climate Commitment Act, which is the Cap and Invest program. And this is pretty big, you know, given that we've just had 937, which was the Interindependence Act requiring utilities to buy green power. Then we had the CETA, which was just passed, and now we have an additional legislation coming up, which probably will pass, although Waputo lists it as having concerns about it. This is going to drive up the cost of to our customers. There's no doubt about that. And this is a kind of a cap and trade. They're not calling it that, but that's what's happening. And again, the concern is that there will be pancaking between this legislation and CETA and the Energy Independence Act. So each one of those are kind of stair-stepping up our rates and requirements as we go along. Also, there was legislation supported by Waputo concerning wildfire management, and that's something that has not been addressed in great detail in the past. It sounds like it's going to get more attention now. We had a legislator at the one of the meetings in previous weeks that said, well, this only becomes an issue when the fires are burning to the legislators. So hopefully they will pass some legislation which will fund and do more for managing wildfires. I also attended the board of directors meeting. I don't want to be critical, but I'll just make an observation. A big chunk of that meeting was taken up with getting to know you, which was new commissioners and even staff, where they give a little speech on their backgrounds and all that. And that's all well and fine. That's great. I enjoy hearing that. But it did take up a lot of the agenda. So anyway, just an observation.
Well, I agree with that. That should have been three. When it started, they said 3 minutes, because I was one of the first ones to do this a couple of years ago.
Yeah, yeah, they blew through that. yeah, unbelievable. And so anyway, not to be critical, this week we've got I've got meetings with the Energy Northwest Executive Board. We're having a joint meeting with the Board of Directors. A lot of interesting issues will come up, and I'll report on those later. But for now, and a lot of the subcommittees are meeting as well, so there will be a lot to talk about next time. And I guess that's all I have. Let's move on to staff reports. By the way, that that comment that I made about the EIM and in the Energy Committee, I maybe we need to talk further about that and take some position on that, given that there's a number of lawsuits out there. Even the state of Oregon has challenged the EIM. So anyway, moving on, staff reports. First one, update of Panoramic Heights Water System. Tom, are you on?
Yes, I am.
Well, have at it.
Okay. Good afternoon, commissioners. I'm reporting on a water quality emergency that arose at our Panoramic Heights water system last Tuesday. I'll give you the short story first, and then I'll get into more details. The Panoramic water system is located about 3 miles south of the Port Angeles High School. It was built in the 1970s, and there are 17 residential service connections in the system. It's our smallest water system, and we took over operation of it in 1996. Last Tuesday, high chlorine concentration was detected about 11:30 in the morning. We contacted the Department of Health regional engineer immediately, and then issued a do not use notice at 12:15. In the afternoon, we diagnosed the problem and repaired it. And we also delivered bottled water to each house right on there by the front door. Crews went out that night to check that the reservoir was filling and the pump was continuing to run, the well pump. It is a groundwater source there. And by 11:30 on Wednesday morning, the next morning, we lifted the notice. and return to normal operations in the afternoon. So that's the short story. The long story is during routine monitoring on Tuesday, the crew measured an unusually high concentration of chlorine in the pump station. The previous Friday before the long weekend, it was we monitored that chlorine level and it was normal. So over the weekend, it started to increase. The crew reported that the well pump was not running, but the chlorine pumps continued to run. So the chlorine pumps actually recirculate water through the reservoir. They inject chlorine into that recirculation line. It's mixed with raw groundwater coming out of the well, and which normally dilutes that concentration feed or chlorine feed. Well, you know, the well pump stopped running and the chlorine continued to be added to the recirculation, and that caused the concentration in the reservoir to exceed the maximum contamination limit. So immediately when we found that out, the crew shut off the reservoir outlet valve, and after reporting the levels to department management. Communications were critical during the event. The crew coordinator, superintendent, department manager, myself, communications manager, kept the general manager, the State Department of Health, and our customers informed throughout the emergency response and recovery. The State Department of Health provided guidance throughout. Per our emergency response plan, Superintendent Bowen Kendrick and I contacted the Department of Health regional engineer immediately. Her name is Jocelyn Gray. She directed us to issue the do not use notice immediately, and she helped us diagnose the problem. Crew coordinator Travis McLean sent phone messages and door hangers with a notice within about an hour of detecting the problem. Initially, it was not clear why the well pump was not running. There were several possible causes and associated solutions. The reactivation of the emergency well nearby was considered, but that would take a lot of time and money. Also, the well pump motor in the existing well could have failed and we needed to pull it out and replace it. That would also take a fair amount of time and money. You know, it was about 2 years ago since we had pump problems there, and it was due to a failure of some electronic devices that control the motor. The well pump is driven by a small 3-horsepower motor, single phase. And we decided to call Straits Electric, our electrical contractor who's familiar with the pump controls. They responded immediately and discovered that the root cause of the problem was the same malfunctioning capacitor in the pump control panel. They replaced it with a spare that we keep in the pump station. The pump was operational again by mid-afternoon, and refilling of the reservoir resumed. And in the meantime, the crew continued their response. They measured high chlorine levels in the reservoir and in the distribution system. They procured and distributed a case of bottled water per household right to the front doorstep, and they placed door hangers on houses that did not answer our phone calls with a do-not-use notice. They emptied the reservoir through the drain line and dechlorinated the discharge before we released it to the environment. Superintendent Kendrick continued to coordinate with Department of Health Regional Engineer and Communications Manager Nicole Hartman. The Department of Health Engineer provided bullets for our notice to be sent out on social media. A customer actually responded to this initial phone notification with questions about the health effects of high chlorine concentrations. And we asked Department of Health about that, who informed us that the health concerns are actually related to long-term exposure and not to any short-term acute effects. So although there could be people and pets actually with sensitive skin that may have experienced some problems, per Department of Health, our social media posts recommended that the customer should contact the physician or veterinarian with any health concerns. Also, the posts informed customers that the crew will be working on recovering from the equipment failure during the night. The crew confirmed that the well continued to fill the reservoir, but the level was too low to start or restart the chlorination recirculation system. We provided updates throughout the recovery process. And the first thing in the morning, the crew went out, restarted chlorination, began flushing the distribution system, and at 11:25 in the morning, the next morning, the do not use notice was lifted via phone calls and door hangers again. Customers were advised to flush their household plumbing before using the water. Normal operations resumed per Department of Health direction. We needed to test the purity of the distribution system. The crew took standard samples to the county water quality lab to be tested for total coliform bacteria. The next day, the samples came back satisfactory, which is good. It's clean. Superintendent Kendrick and I developed a phase plan to correct the root cause of the problem and to improve the monitoring system. The chlorination system should only run when there's direct evidence that the well pump motor is running. And we do that by connecting an amp meter and monitoring that and using a PLC to control or send out alarms when that situation may occur. And also, we need to set up a data communications to be installed on site to connect the control system and the pump station to our SCADA system. So that's the long story. If you have any questions, please.
So Tom, how is this overchlorination detected?
Well, right now it's with our routine monitoring and
that's what I'm asking. Was it sampling or was it complaints from the customers or what?
No, it was we sent out a crew to sample the chlorine levels in the pump station.
All right. So with this monitoring of the pump by PLC control and alarm, then you would be able to detect this pretty early in the future, right?
Right.
Okay, great. Sounds good. Other questions, comments? Okay. All right, so that concludes that. Okay, I'm going to bring up something here that I think we should probably defer an in-depth discussion to the future, but this thing that a position on the EIM and the Snake River Dams that seems to be confusing our staff, as Jim pointed out, we need to clear that up. So what I would propose is that we direct staff to come up with resolutions on that. And so staff will know what the policy is of this PUD. Any comments?
Okay, Bill, those are two pretty heavyweight subjects in terms of information. So is the staff going to produce that, or how? What are we going to do for inputs on that?
Well, the inputs will come when the resolutions come back to the board, and we can talk about it in depth. It's become kind of an elephant in the room. Staff is confused. The overwhelming number of PUDs out there are confused about our position on this. So I just think it's time that it's kind of become the elephant in the room. So we need to probably go ahead and define our position and our policy and give direction to staff as well as other utilities. Okay, well, good. Let's do that, and we can talk about it when that comes before us. All right. action items. Do we have, T, did you capture any action items?
No, sir, I did not capture any action items.
Okay. The only item that I would recommend is those that resolution that I just discussed.
Well, yes, I mean, except for those two that we have to come up with.
Okay, let's go back to comments from the public. Sean, do we have any?
Well, on my agenda, I had one more thing under staff reports for Mike Hill. Has that been?
Oh, my goodness. I'm sorry. Okay, this is an update on efforts to mitigate avian and power line interactions near Kirshner Road. Mike, are you on?
I am. First, okay.
Sorry to bring you out of the agenda. Go ahead.
Thanks, Sean. I don't know how aware you guys are of the swan issue at that corner of Kerner and Woodcock Roads in Squim, but I'll give you a brief history. In 2015, we were contacted by Fish and Wildlife from I think some neighbors down there where some swans were coming into the contact of the power lines and some being injured and some dying. I don't have numbers there. But we did put up bird diverters at that time on the lines to help the birds see the power lines before they got to them. We were contacted again in 2017 about burying the lines, and we did provide an estimate to those customers. Hadn't heard from them again for a long time, as far as I know. Recently, in November of last year, I was contacted by Fish and Wildlife of a swan that hit the lines and died along Woodcock Road. And then another contact on the 9th of December. I'm not sure which span of lines that was in. But nonetheless, I've been talking with Fish and Wildlife and the Audubon Group, and what they would like is to bury a span of lines along Kerner Road that just seems to be the most troublesome spot. I did provide them with an estimate for the QD cost to do that, which was close to around $40,000. It'd still be the customer group responsibility to hire a contractor to perform the trenching and for them to take care of permitting and any easements that are maybe required. I went a little bit further than I normally would on a project like this, so I talked to Clallam County Road Department to see what they would allow as far as trenching in their right-of-way. It turns out that steep slope on both sides of Kerner Road, they would prefer no trenching in the road. So they'd like the trenching at the bottom of the slope and then also bore across Kerner Road rather than an open cut. So those would be something that the customer's contractor would have to take care of. But I was just trying to help the group steer them in the right direction if they were, because what they'd like to do is raise funds to bury those lines. I asked them to, there's been various questions on how many swans hit the lines, where, when, and how many died or were injured. I've asked that group to put together a list, and they have not provided that to me yet. And I believe they're planning to come to a commissioner meeting in the near future to show some videos and a flyer that they made out to help raise funds for the project. That's all I have. If you got any questions.
Okay, Mike, thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Questions, comments? Okay, so we've done action items. Now we'll go back to comments from the public. Sean, do you have anybody?
If anybody wants to make a comment, go ahead and give me your first name. Hearing none, Will.
Oh, good. I'm disappointed.
Oh, I'm, Sean.
Yeah.
My name is Janet, and I'd like to make a comment.
Oh, okay.
It took a while to figure out how to interact with you.
Go ahead, Janet.
Oh, okay. I'm a ratepayer. And I was a bit overwhelmed by, and I'm going back to this favorite subject of yours, the dues that we are paying to different organizations. I have no interest in what other PUDs are paying to their EDCs, I see no advantage to the PUD paying dues to our EDC. I would think some of you would remember the long history of our CUDs, the promises made without follow-up. I don't understand how you think the joining these EDC would make it has any advantage. You mentioned marketing and customer base, but I would think your staff would be able to take care of that. What other options do businesses have? It's not like you're competing with other businesses. And then the other one is, the, of course, the Northwest River Partnership. And I think Christine said it pretty well, but I want, this just sounds like a one-horse object advertising group. And as well, and as Will himself said, they do not produce data. So what is their value except to help them advertise? And I would really be opposed to that hefty 30,000 plus going to that group. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments?
I didn't hear any others, Will.
Okay. I guess we're at the end of the agenda. If there's no other business to come before, well, do we have any comments from Jim or Rick?
No, I don't guess so. Just address the last comment about Northwest River Partners. Finishing my conversation a while ago, I said recommended that we, not pay them. I don't know. I know that I probably won't get anywhere with a motion, but because I didn't hear any feedback one way or the other from you two, Will and Rick. But if that's going to stay in place, then I guess we'll have to, I'll have to look at what they're saying and comment to the board.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds reasonable. Okay. If there's no other business to come before the commission, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much.